Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we're back with part two of our two-part exploration of the depths of the sea, the history of knowledge and exploration of the deep sea. And this time we're really going to be focusing in on William Beebe.
That's right. We alluded to him at the beginning of the last episode. So he was an American naturalist, explorer, author. He lived from 1877 to 1962. And he was a very interesting fellow, just to put it mildly. Before there was Neil deGrasse Tyson or Carl Sagan or even Jacques Cousteau, there was William Beebe, who some writers have called the first celebrity scientist. So he traveled around and lectured. He wrote books. He received quite a bit of media coverage.
And he was actually, in writing books, he was a good writer,
yes,
which is a thing that helps.
Yeah, he was a good popularizer of science. He was a great science communicator before this was really that much of a thing.
Yeah. I often think of Darwin as a great science communicator. But yeah, Beebe really took it to the next level, especially as we'll talk about in a minute, by employing all kinds of people to help spread the message of scientific discoveries in ways that are easily digestible to the public.
Yeah, so he was an ornithologist at the New York Zoological Society, and he actually left college before completing his degree in order to work. For the society, but he's one of these guys who just seemed to really just ascend once he hit the ground working. He ended up becoming the founder of the society's Department of Tropical Research, mm-hmm. and he conducted research. It's worth noting, across two world wars and the Great Depression. Like, that was the time period, the trying time period, a time when most of the energy in the world seemed to be aimed at either conducting warfare, surviving economic depression. But he was able to successfully carry out a great deal of research and then communicate the Department of Tropical Research's work as well. And to do this, he enlisted not only scientists but also historians, writers, and artists. And by this, I mean he took artists with him on his expeditions, generating some really captivating artwork. And Beebe himself sketched the creatures that he saw in the depths. I mean, it's really kind of surprising, however, though, that given that he was such a celebrity at the time, that we don't see him celebrated as much in pop culture today. Like, he certainly, again, he's remembered. It's not like he's forgotten and lost to history, but you would just think that he would have more of a Tesla status today.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that, again, before we went to this recent exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History in New York about the unseen depths of the ocean, had some stuff about BB. Before that, I think maybe I was a little bit aware of him but didn't really know anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's crazy because his life and his work was so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if for starters, he influenced a number of notable people. For instance, E.O. Wilson, who we've discussed on the show before, has pointed to William Beebe as someone who inspired his scientific career.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting things about Beebe's legacy. One cool one that does get mentioned sometimes is the fact that he was criticized during his life for hiring and mentoring female researchers, which a lot of irritable, sexist establishment scientists of the time thought was an indication that his work was not serious or was unprofessional. But of course, they were wrong, right? Beebe helped give a leg up to great scientists like Jocelyn Crane, who studied, among other things, invertebrate ethology, so the behavior of invertebrates with a special focus on fiddler crabs, and also the explorer and research scientist Gloria Hollister, who pioneered lab techniques for preparing marine specimens, and she herself actually performed dives in the capsule that we're going to be talking about more in this episode, the bathysphere, the steel ball that finally took us down into the depths.
Mm-hmm. Some of the females he employed were also artists as well. There's actually a wonderful New York Times article that came out just last year about an exhibition of various works from this period that I recommend everyone check out. If you just look for William Beebe, Department of Tropical Research illustrations, you'll find it. And there are some fabulous illustrations of, say, the bathysphere descending into the depths with strange creatures swirling around it.
Yeah, if you get a chance, you should look up illustrations, especially, I would say, of the artist Elsa Bostelmann, who she was one of the artists who accompanied his research, and she sketched and painted what Beebe and his companion Otis Barton saw in the deep from the bathysphere, which we're going to be talking about more later. But her work is just beautiful and weird and superb. It's excellent science art.
Yeah, for reasons that will become obvious as we proceed, photography or certainly film was just not an option aboard the bathysphere. So they had to depend on sketches. And also just you have to consider the time during which all this was taking place. For instance, one of his dives was actually broadcast on NBC Radio, which is a testament to the popularity of his work, but also just shows you the limitations of the visual technology at the time.
Now, of course, another great weird note in pop culture is that Beebe's collaborator, Otis Barton, who was his co-pilot in the bathysphere and one of the people, I think the main designer of the bathysphere, made a movie based on what they did.
Yeah, 1938's Titans of the Deep. And if you look at the poster art for this film, and I'll try to include it on the landing page for this episode, it's stuff to blow your mind, it creates certain expectations of the content.
Yeah, I will say it. So it's supposed to be like a documentary film.
Right. They made it as a documentary, apparently. And even though it's like Beebe is mentioned on the poster, apparently Beebe wasn't himself super involved in the production.
Yeah, I've seen it actually described as more of like an action movie or an exploitation horror movie. I couldn't find this movie, so I didn't get to watch it.
Yeah, I was not able to find even any footage from it or a trailer or what would pass for a trailer.
But you can definitely get a sense of the vibe they were going for if you just look at the poster, which is, of course has like a vague whale-shaped sea monster with this big sawtooth face and then a dude with a harpoon poised to hit it. It looks in composition like the much later poster for the movie Journey to the Seventh Planet, which is this 1962 sci-fi barbecue about a bunch of astronauts who fly out to explore Uranus and then get this they essentially end up with a de-intellectualized version of the plot from Solaris, and the movie stars, of course, John Agar.
Ah, yes, a frequent name for anyone who's ever plunged the depths of B movies from that era.
But if you look at this poster for Journey to the Seventh Planet, I don't know if it was actually inspired by Titans of the Deep, but they look very similar to me.
I also found an image. This was an advertisement, but it turns out even Otis Barton, who accompanied William Beebe in the bathysphere, he was famous enough at the time to appear in a Camel advertisement for Camel cigarettes, where you see him featured there, and he's saying, "I smoke as many Camels as I like. They don't give me jittery nerves.
Nope.
Camels have a swell taste, mild and yet with rich, mellow flavor.
I smoke them all in the bathysphere."
I do not think the bathysphere is a good smoking environment.
Two packs per dive. Well, we've been teasing it enough. I think maybe we should take a quick break, and then when we come back, we should discuss the bathysphere itself.
All right. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we're back.
All right, so I will refer you to an image, like a photograph of the bathysphere on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com, but we're also going to describe it for you here. So no need to pull the car over or what have you, depending on how you're listening to us.
Okay.
So as you're trying to imagine the bathysphere, it's probably best to dismiss some of your more modern and TV-friendly notions of exploratory submarines, because the bathysphere was less of a submarine and more of just a death trap.
Right. It's like, would you like to get inside a bowling ball and go to the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah. A steel ball that men climb inside and then it is lowered into the ocean depth.
Now, let's ask some questions. Does this have a propeller?
No.
Does it have fins?
No.
Does it have robotic arms?
No.
Does it have really anything on the outside other than just a steel sphere?
I mean, basically, it is a steel bowling ball that men climb inside through what BB referred to just as the door. And then
well,
it has
even door is a little misleading,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really a door. They got in through a hole that was then bolted shut.
Right. See, yeah, it sealed shut like an iron casket. And then it has these three portals that they look out of that look kind of like stubby eye stalks.
So, Robert, how big was the bathysphere that these two people got into?
Well, here's a quick quote from Beebe from his biography, Half Mile Down,
okay.
which we're going to refer to a lot. If we read a quote from Beebe in this and we don't fully attribute it, it's from Half Mile Down.
Uh-huh.
Beebe says, "It was not as tall as a man, measuring only 4 feet 9 inches in diameter, but its walls were everywhere 1.25 inches thick, and it weighed 5,400 pounds." A first casting had weighed twice as much, but it would have been too heavy for any of the winches available in Bermuda and was junked.
Now, about this steel ball, if you don't have an intuitive sense of numbers to physical scale, I want to pause for a second and dwell on how tiny this is. You can buy beach balls bigger than this undersea exploration vessel.
That's crazy. You included a picture here on our notes showing what a 60-inch beach ball looks like next to presumably an average-sized individual.
I guess this is probably a tall guy, but
but still, imagine two of him inside of it.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that's bigger than the bathysphere was. This was, I mean, this thing was tiny. People, like, they were crammed inside.
Yeah.
But there was a reason it had to be that small, right?
Yeah, because as William J. Broad points out in his book, The Universe Below, the smaller the sphere, the greater strength of its walls. If you had more space in there, you'd need thicker walls.
Which would, of course, mean increasing the weight of the thing.
Right.
We
run into the problem with the winches that we've already discussed.
It's almost like a parallel of the problems of shielding from radiation in space, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you want to send up a spacecraft that'll protect the astronauts with really thick shielding in the walls, but you've got a problem with getting so much mass up into space that, you know, you could have all these really, really thick walls. It's like a parallel to that. You know, you could have really, really thick walls to make sure you're super protected from the pressure and you've got enough room to move around, but it just gets harder and harder to get you down into the depths and back up safely if you do that.
Yeah. So this was designed by Beebe and American engineer Otis Barton, who I already mentioned, and it featured 3 viewing portals. And this was not glass. You couldn't just look out just normal glass because it needed to withstand the pressure. This was fused quartz, 8 inches in diameter and 3 inches thick. And the fittings, again, they look like stubby eye stalks.
It's like a three-eyed monster.
Yeah. And quartz was used because it was the, quote, strongest transparent substance known, and it transmits all wavelengths of light.
Now, earlier we mentioned the door that wasn't really a door. What does BB say about the door?
He describes it as a, quote, round 400-pound lid that, quote, had to be lifted on and off by a block and tackle and fitted snugly over 10 large bolts around the manhole, the latter just big enough to permit the passage of a slender human body.
BB was a very slender guy, we should point out. I've seen pictures of him, and he is spindly.
Now, on top of that, let's discuss some of the other attributes, physical attributes of the bathysphere. It had a single external light.
Just 1,000 watts, mm-hmm. one light.
And you flipped it on or off from inside. And the sphere was lowered on a single steel non-twisting cable, nearly an inch in diameter, with a braking strain of 29 tons, or a dozen bathyspheres.
Okay, so they wanted to be real safe, because, of course, if that cable breaks, you're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, you're done for.
Yeah,
and
see
you,
ya.
And you have to worry about more than just what happens if the cable breaks. So you have to worry about, well, what if there's stormy weather, et cetera.
Now, you mentioned there's a light on the thing, so that means they got to get power down there somehow.
Yeah, so they had an additional cable that carried both the electrical power and the telephone wires.
Oh, telephone wires. So they had to have some way to communicate with the service.
Right.
I assume they couldn't just tug on the cable.
Yeah, I don't think that would work. Yeah. But yeah, this was kind of the limits of their connections to the surface.
Right.
They had electricity coming down, and they had that telephone wire. They did not have an air tube coming down.
No.
But of course, they had to breathe.
Right.
So the bathysphere included oxygen tanks with automatic valves that provided the atmosphere. And then they just had trays of chemicals setting out.
I believe it was soda lime and calcium chloride.
Yeah. And this was to absorb moisture and carbon dioxide.
Yeah, because you don't just need fresh air to breathe in. You need to scrub the carbon dioxide that you're breathing out.
Yeah. I would just want to drive home how – I mean, it's an amazing invention, but how dangerously crude it can feel.
Yeah.
It reminds me of there was a 1980s film. Was it The Voyagers?
The Explorers?
The Explorers, yes, where the kids build this kind of spaceship that sets inside like a magic force field sphere. But they just build it, right? They just construct it from what they have at hand. And there's a similar vibe with the bathysphere. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just so ballsy to imagine climbing in this thing and descending into the depth.
I mean, it
is a large ball.
It is a steel ball.
Yes. And it, even though it holds two divers and is essentially a two-man crew, BB says that the total crew required to support this thing, most of which are going to be members on the surface, it comes to around 28 people total. So two under the water, 26 above the water.
All right. So let's say you're William Beebe and you're like, okay, I've got a steel ball to die in. where are we going to put this down in the water?
Well, they set their sights on the deep seas off the coast of Bermuda, specifically a circular area about 8 miles in diameter near Nonsuch Island. And here the depth reached about a mile. The first dive occurred in 1930. By June 11th, 1930, they'd reached a depth of 1,300 feet or 400 meters. And in 1934, they reached 3,000 feet or 900 meters.
And that was, of course, by far the world record.
Yes.
They went much lower than anybody had ever been able to explore before.
Yeah, they were really breaking new grounds with this. Now, the bathysphere greatly improved humanity's ability to explore the depths. But again, it was ultimately a risky vessel to use.
Yeah.
And it was soon replaced by safer designs, including the bathyscaphe, which positioned a traditional bathysphere beneath a large float.
Uh-huh.
And even the likes of the modern Deep Sea Challenger, famously piloted by James Cameron, that boasts a pilot sphere positioned beneath the rest of the vessel. So you can think of post-bathysphere designs as just basically being the bathysphere attached to a larger system of flotation.
A submarine, basically.
A submarine. Yeah. Basically, like, let's attach this to a submarine that has power, that has the ability to raise and lower itself within the water. But the bathysphere was just the sphere, just this steel container for the humans to descend in.
Having your own power really does seem to make a difference, right? I mean, there's a huge difference between being in a submarine that can move and just hanging in a ball on a thread.
Yeah, I mean, just the psychological notion here, just the idea that, hey, if I get tired of descending into the darkness of the deep sea, then I can raise myself out of this. I have some level of control, and I'm not just hoping that everything's going okay up there on the surface.
Now, of course, by virtue of the fact that BB and his team went deeper than anyone ever had before, he got to observe far more than anyone ever had before. So I think we should go into his scientific observations.
And we'll do that right after this break.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back.
So William Beebe, the modern Gilgamesh, he and his co-pilot are in the ball, in the steel death trap, sinking down, down, down into the ocean, deeper than anybody's ever gone before, and looking out the portholes to see what they can see. So let's talk about what they see. What did they discover through this research method?
Well, Beebe observed and sketched, again, because cameras of the day were largely useless given the conditions of the bathysphere and its environment. Mm-hmm. But he described a world, quote, stranger than any imagination could have conceived.
And he writes about it very beautifully.
Oh, yeah. And he really brought the results. Between 1929 and 1937, Beebe and his team caught more than 115,000 animals from 220 species, many of which were new to science.
So they were combining different research methods at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into some of the specific creatures that he saw or claimed to have seen, we should probably just talk about his experience with darkness and light, because ultimately that is that's kind of the defining experience that he describes.
Oh, exactly. So Beebe writes, quote, In the course of the half mile down, although my eyes were perfectly dark adapted, I could detect not the faintest glimmer of light from 1,700 feet down. So as far as the human eye was concerned, conditions of absolute darkness existed at these deeper levels. And then he says, from 1,700 feet down, animal light is the only external source of illumination. So, of course, they did have a light they could flip on, but they didn't want to do that all the time, right? Because that would be affecting and changing the environment. So they didn't do that always. They would try to see often just what they could see in the dark that was self-illuminated. And when you go that far down, there actually are very many bioluminescent creatures that will illuminate themselves for you to see, but they'll also illuminate the water so that you can see other animals around them. And Beebe writes, quote, "Occasionally, the head of a fish would appear conspicuously against the surrounding black, illumined by some indirect source of unknown lighting. Eyes especially stood out with no definite source of light visible. When teeth were thus silhouetted, I knew it was from a luminous mucus which covered them. Cheek lights flashed and dimmed or vanished altogether, showing some control other than the usual disappearance into an opaque epidermal trench." And I should mention those last quotes I provided came from a paper he published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 1932 or 33.
Yeah, he was extremely impressed by the display of bioluminescence as he descended. So he noted the lights of fish, jellies, and various animals that he couldn't really identify in passing. And it was something of a revelation to him. About a third of a mile down, he saw something that he described as a, quote, pyrotechnic network, and it was, quote, so delicate and evanescent that its abyssal form is quite lost if we ever take it in our nets.
Wow.
So in other words, if we were just to pull this up, you know, what would we have? We would have maybe some shriveled mass, but we certainly would not have this floating bioluminescent thing that I'm witnessing right now.
Well, in the last episode, we talked about the sea cucumber that turns to red Kool-Aid. Here you would, I guess, turn into bioluminescent Kool-Aid.
And then there's this description of the abyssal rainbow gars, which we'll come back to later on. He says, "At 11:17 o'clock, I turned the light on suddenly and saw a strange quartet of fish to which I have not been able to fit genus or family. Shape, size, color, and one fin I saw clearly, but abyssal rainbow gars is as far as I dare go." In other words, he's saying that's as far as I dare go in classifying it and naming it.
Uh-huh.
Quote, "And they may be anything but gars, about 4 inches overall. They were slender and stiff with long, sharply pointed jaws." And it's worth noting no one has ever captured a specimen quite like this, nor seen it. And this is one of the mysteries that arises from William Beebe's observations. Specimens that have not been caught or even witnessed again. And we're left to wonder, well, what did he see?
Right. Did he have access somehow to seeing things no one has actually seen since then? Or was he mistaken? Did he think he was seeing something that he actually wasn't? Or was he making it up? I mean, I don't want to think he was making it up, but I guess we have to consider that as a possibility.
Yeah. And we'll touch on that, some of the thinking on that a little later. But one thing we should go ahead and drive home here is that, again, the bathysphere did not have an engine on it. It did not have propellers. It was a very silent affair in a realm where sound truly carries.
Yeah.
And can have damaging effects, especially our modern state of affairs with ships and sonar. But even just a noisy submarine would have potentially scared away various species. So there is an argument to be made here that the bathysphere, as it's descending rather silently and at times in complete darkness, would have attracted or been or at least would not have frightened away species that would recoil from a modern exploratory submarine.
That's interesting, and that's a good point to keep in mind. As we go on and discuss some more of the things he recorded seeing, I think if you have the ability while you're listening, you should look up some of the artworks of Elsa Bostelmann. She was, again, one of the artists who was doing sketches for Beebe's team. And so it would be great to have some of those in front of your eyes while we're talking here.
Now, another variety of fish that Beebe reported seeing are the dragonfish.
Now, these are different than sea dragons.
Right. Quote, "A 6-inch dragonfish or Stomias passed. Lights first visible, then 3 seconds of searchlight for identification, then lights alone, and there seemed no reason why we should not swing the door open and swim out. Now, I can think of various reasons not to do that, BB, but I understand that he's trying to capture his excitement here.
It's the deep sea version of the thing, like, you know, the sudden desire to the call of the void, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or the desire to, like, swerve into oncoming traffic.
So this was his guess that these were dragonfish. And again, we have to put ourselves in the bathysphere and imagine peering out through these tiny quartz lenses at things just swimming by, mm-hmm. sometimes lingering, but maybe not. Sometimes wholly visible for a few seconds, sometimes only partially visible. But he guessed that these were some variety of dragonfish. And the particular species that he was describing was unknown to science at the time. But he was familiar with other species of Stomias. Now, he apparently reported seeing a 6-foot dragonfish as well. As marine biologist and author Richard Ellis discusses in his book, Singing Whales and Flying Squid, The Discovery of Marine Life. So to put that in perspective, I believe the largest known dragonfish at the time was a mere 15 inches in length.
Wow. I mean, if you look up what dragonfish look like, they are... It is terrifying to imagine a 6-foot-long one. It's kind of like, in fact, I would compare it very much to the discovery of the 6-foot-long Cambrian predator Anomalocaris, right?
Yeah.
The idea that something that creepy could get that big is really disturbing.
Yeah, so these creatures were members of the order Stomiformes, which also includes the viperfish, which BB also notes on his dives. Now, in the introduction to the novel Starfish, the author Peter Watts, who was also also has a marine biology background, he mentions BB having reported a 7-foot viperfish. Now, I don't doubt Watts in this, but I can't personally find a reference to this particular sighting. But then again, I didn't look at all of the scientific papers that that BB put out over the years.
Uh-huh.
But he certainly mentions viperfish in his biography. And the idea, if you look up a picture of a viperfish, again, it's very much like the dragonfish, this sharp-toothed, long, fierce eel-like creature, and to imagine a 7-foot version of this swimming past you as you're cramped in your steel beach ball. It's just terrifying to imagine.
Yeah. Well, it swims up to the window to say, hey, I'm here to vosh and vipe your windows.
What is that from?
Oh, you don't remember that story, The Viper?
No.
I think it was in that book, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
No, I remember the book, or at least the illustration, yeah.
Bad joke if it didn't land. Sorry. I mean, no. I mean, there's a story called The Viper about a guy who keeps calling on the phone who says, like, I am the Viper and I'm coming. And somebody gets really scared because the Viper is coming. And then finally when the Viper gets there, he says he's there to vosh and vipe the windows.
Oh, because he's really the Viper.
Right.
Okay. No, I think the joke will work for people who know the reference. I just didn't catch it.
Jokes are always better when you spend a few minutes explaining them, you know.
All right, well, let's move on to another sighting that BB reported, that of the great fish. And I believe we read a little bit from this one at the top of the first episode.
Oh, yeah,
series.
Yeah. So what was this great fish?
Well, he describes it essentially as just this wall of flesh passing him by in the faint light, something that he guessed to be about 20 feet long.
Wow.
And it could have been a number of things. So he thinks it might have been some manner of whale, mm-hmm. and it could have been a sperm whale, for instance, which is, as we've discussed on the show in our Leviathan episode, is a large creature and it can dive much deeper than the bathysphere,
and can get much bigger than 20 feet.
Correct. Yes. Now, however, it's also been brought up so that it could have been some kind of a deep sea shark. Because in 1975, marine biologist managed to glimpse and photograph 6-gill sharks at a depth of 2,460 feet. And so Ellis suggests that it's possible that BB could have seen this, or perhaps a deep sea shark such as the Greenland shark, whose range apparently includes Bermuda's waters.
Huh. Okay, now you know one of everybody's favorite deep sea creatures is, of course, the tricksy anglerfish.
Oh, yes, because the image of the anglerfish with its large gaping mouth and sharp teeth and then that strange bioluminescent lure that hangs in front of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just such an amazing looking creature. And that's without even getting into its extremely bizarre reproductive methods.
Oh, with the tiny male.
The tiny male that's like a little reproductive heat seeker that then fuses with her body.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've discussed that on the show before. But he did have a run-in with the anglerfish. Here's another quote from Half Mile Down. Quote, another interesting fish on this trip was one which I saw by the light of our electric beam at 1,900 feet on the way up. It was one of the true giant female anglerfish, a full 2 feet in length with enormous mouth and teeth. Deep and thick, with a long tentacle arising from the top of its head, I saw no light from this, but it was distinct for a moment in the surrounding illumination. Twice its mouth opened and partially shut, and then we passed out of its life. Three of these weird fish have been taken dead at the surface, but 3 years of intensive trawling have given us no hint of their presence here. For a few seconds, I was within 10 feet of one, and the memory will never leave me.
Yeah, I'd guess in the steel ball in the deep, you make a lot of memories.
All right, so one of the things we've discussed here is that so many of these sightings can definitely be backed up. Many of these sightings were creatures that are known to science, and we have specimens for them. But others remain a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, it is necessarily subjective reporting. Like we said, the photography of the time could not capture things. So now if you take a deep sea sub down, you can videotape the whole thing so you can prove what you saw when you came back. Here we have to rely on the word of the people who were in the bathysphere looking out.
Right. And that led even scientists at the time to question some of it. So ichthyologist Carl Hubbs, for instance, he had some issues with the reported bioluminescence. And he suggested in 1933, quote, I am forced to suggest that whatever the author saw might have been a phosphorescent coelenterate whose lights were beautified by halation in passing through a misty film breathed onto the quartz window by Mr. Beebe's eagerly oppressed face.
I like the snooty voice you give Hubs there.
Well, I do get a very like snooty, intellectual, like stuffy academic vibe here saying, who is this science popularizer, without an advanced degree, daring to report on the secrets of the deep?
Yeah, I mean, you're naturally, I think a modern person is sort of naturally inclined to be on BB's side here, especially because of, like, we see him being criticized for non-legitimate reasons, like, you're hiring women researchers, that's nonsense. So you kind of like naturally want to say like, okay, if people are coming at him with criticisms, they're not fair. But some criticisms might be fair while other ones aren't.
Yeah, I mean, it comes back around to the fact that we are depending upon his observations and the observations of Otis. And in many cases, it's not like both of them saw the same thing. They're looking out of different windows.
Yeah.
There are several cases where BB says, oh, and then Otis saw this creature and I really wish I could have seen it, but I didn't. Or likewise, it's something that only BB saw and Otis was looking at something else.
Yeah.
Now, in all of this, I'm personally inclined to believe BB, or at least I really want to believe him.
Yeah.
And I have not conducted an exhaustive analysis of his personality or anything. But based on what we've read about him and his work, he seems to have been a very meticulous researcher who cared about accurately presenting what was going on in the ocean.
Well, Ellis had an opinion on that, right?
He does. So Ellis writes, quote, it is possible that Beebe was the only person ever to see these mysterious creatures. It is also possible that he made them up. But although he wrote very cleverly and well, there is very little in his published work to indicate that he was a practical joker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to play devil's advocate, though, Ellis does point out that Beebe might have possibly joked at one point about lights being those of, quote, a giant toadfish, and that perhaps Beebe, having neither a graduate or undergraduate degree, wanted to, quote, put one over on the academics. And it's also worth noting that he would have not been the first to play such a prank. Ellis points to a 1933 prank by Australian ichthyologist Gilbert Whitley. And he makes the point that Beebe would have known that his observations were fairly safe for the foreseeable future. So, in other words, he could have made something up and known that, hey, if future explorers come down to the same part of the ocean, the same depth, and they don't see it, that in no way disproves what I'm claiming to have seen.
Right.
His reports, quote, would enter the literature, as they have done, with virtually no possibility of being discounted. It is, after all, one of the basic tenets of cryptozoology that negative evidence cannot be disproved.
A fact beloved by chupacabra movie purveyors everywhere.
Yes. So Ellis stresses that, look, we simply don't know. Another 1,000 or 10,000 dives might be required to really prove any of this out. But he says that the very fact that some of these specimens have not been seen since Beebe, that casts their existence into doubt.
Yeah. But now also, as I think we have said before, Beebe did see some things that were not known about at the time but have since been verified.
Yeah. I mean, in the vast majority of the deep sea fishes he describes are confirmed by specimens. And in one case, the, quote, untouchable bathysphere fish did turn out to be a species of dragonfish later found to inhabit the middle layers of the ocean where he reported them.
Yeah.
So for many of these creatures, perhaps we simply haven't seen them again. The ocean is a big place and one that contains plenty of mystery. Perhaps these species have suffered or gone extinct due to the damage that humans have inflicted on the ocean.
That's highly possible.
Yeah. Or as we've discussed, perhaps these creatures were more easily seen by the silent, motorless bathysphere as it descended through the depths. The aquatic environment, after all, is quite vulnerable to sound.
Yeah. And to go back into the differences of the general methods of sampling the depths, if you've got the Gilgamesh method and the Ebizu method, there are plenty of species that are not very easily picked up by various kinds of Ebizu methods, like whether you're trawling with a net or trying to drag a dredge along, whatever you're doing, there are some species that just tend not to get caught like that.
Yeah. Now, one thing I do want to throw in here is that in some of these discussions of the more mysterious creatures, it tends to fall into extremes, right? Mm-hmm. Either he definitely saw something that we have not seen since, or he just made it up.
Yeah.
Without really addressing the fact that there are a number of possible variations between those two extremes.
I mean, it was dark down there.
It was dark. They're just getting glimpses of things. So I would counter with, isn't it possible that he saw some of these things but misjudged their size, mm-hmm. that he later remembered them a little differently? Like I don't think it is necessary for Beebe to be a prankster or a liar for him to have misreported something that he thought he saw.
Oh, I totally agree there, yeah.
And so, you know, speaking for myself, I'm not inclined to really entertain some of these more nefarious interpretations of his observations.
I was a little thrown when he saw the Kraken the size of an island. Wait, that wasn't Beebe. I'm always confusing Beebe with those medieval Norwegians.
Well, this does raise the question, if he was to make something up,
yeah.
Like, why didn't he go even broader with his descriptions?
Yeah.
But I don't know. That, again, we're getting into areas of pure speculation here.
Well, I like this because it sort of brings us back to the fact that we were discussing earlier and in the last episode about how we know a lot more about the deep than we used to, but we still don't know tons of stuff about the deep oceans. The deep oceans are, it's almost a cliche to say now because people emphasize it so much, but it's very true. They're entirely alien to us. We know very little about them.
Yeah. It's been reported that 95% of the ocean is unexplored. And that's to say it hasn't even been seen with human eyes.
Yeah. I know there are various ways of people disputing that figure, but suffice to say that even large portions of the ocean that are sort of roughly mapped have not actually been seen.
Yeah. As of 2014, less than 0.05% of the ocean floor had been mapped to a level of detail useful for detecting items such as the wreckage of airplanes or the spires of undersea volcanic vents. And I've seen a higher stat in recent years. For instance, according to the Unseen Oceans exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History, only 10 to 15% of the seafloor is revealed to us in accuracy.
Uh-huh.
And in either case, ultimately, we know more about the surface of Mars than the seafloor of our own planet. Part of the issue there, of course, is that we can't use satellites to map the seafloor in the same way that we can use satellites to map the surface of Mars.
Uh-huh.
We have to depend on things like sonar to do it.
Yeah. But at the same time, as we've said, we know a lot more than we used to, and it's exciting that there is so much more to learn.
Indeed. And I think that's why we keep coming back to the ocean on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. We talk about the mysteries of outer space. We talk about the mysteries of the inner mind. And of course, we're going to keep talking about the mysteries of the ocean.
I mean, there's no dragonfish in space.
It's true. Like, the ocean is the mysterious realm in which we know there is alien life, and yeah. We keep discovering new forms.
There may be dragonfish in the mind.
Yes. Oh, undoubtedly, there are dragonfish in the mind. But in the ocean, we can actually pull them up and poke at them.
Though how much better to go down and observe them in their natural habitat rather than pulling them up.
Yeah.
And so that's the legacy of William Beebe in the bathysphere.
That's right. The modern Gilgamesh, as you put it. All right. Well, hey, be sure to check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find this episode, the previous episode, and all the other episodes of the podcast, as well as blog posts and links out to our various social media accounts.
Thanks, as always, to our audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know feedback about this episode or any other episode, to let us know a topic you think maybe we should cover in the future, or just to say hi and let us know your thoughts, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.